I'm Mindy Todd. Welcome to The Point. According to the Centers for Disease Control, as of 2012, half of all adults in the U.S. have one or more chronic health disease, such as diabetes, heart disease, and cancer. And chronic disease is responsible for 7 out of every 10 deaths. Not only does chronic disease compromise the quality of life of those affected, 86% of our nation's health care dollars are spent on the treatment of these diseases. And the number of people with chronic disease is predicted to increase over the next decade. There is good news, however. Many chronic diseases are often preventable and can be managed through early detection, improved diet, and exercise. Eating a more healthful diet can be a challenge. Fresh fruits and vegetables are typically more expensive than packaged and processed foods. For middle and low-income people trying to make ends meet, buying more expensive food may not be an option. So how can we make affordable, healthy foods more accessible and better educate people about the impacts of diet on health? It's a question Dr. Kumar Siddhartha and Francie Randolph are tackling together. Dr. Kumar Siddhartha is a primary care physician and the medical director at Emerald Physicians. Welcome back. Good to see you.
Mindy, good to be back here.
And Francie Randolph is the founding director of Sustainable Cape. Good to have you back as well.
Thank you, Mindy. Good to be here.
All right, so Dr. Sid, you've long been a proponent of a plant-based diet because of the health benefits. And Francie, you've long been a supporter of locally grown foods. So tell us about your collaboration to make locally grown fruits and vegetables both affordable and accessible.
What we know so far in science is that food is medicine. You know, any meal pattern that increases the portion of vegetables and fruits, the higher the better, increases health and decreases the risk for chronic diseases, including cancer, diabetes, heart disease, arthritis, dementia. And we also know that access to food or the healthier foods determines human behavior, whether they choose it or not. More access, we tend to choose more healthy foods. And when we looked at the Barnstable County situation, local situation, Barnstable County ranks number one in Massachusetts County among the counties in having the least access to healthy foods. 10% of the population, according to the latest data from the County Health Rankings database, 10% of the population still have low access to healthy food, which is number one among the counties. So how do we address all of these, you know, access issue, knowing that the food access helps to turn around health? Francie and I, you know, we had the same similar idea without talking to each other for a while, of looking at how healthcare system can start prescribing health, prescribing access to healthy foods for those who have difficult access, and see if it actually improves health, not only the behavior, but also can we just prove it categorically, indisputably, using standard blood tests, measurements that we use to show that whether such an intervention of increasing access to healthy produce changes the health behavior and health outcomes. And that's where the collaboration happened, where Francie has been working on local food and well-being, and connecting farmers. And I'll let Francie say more about that. So we came together, started to look at a program, which we did a smaller pilot in 2016, and we expanded it across the Cape and geographically in 2017 summer, called the Flavor X.
Yeah. Flavor X meaning flavor prescription, right?
Yeah. Yes, yeah. With the flavor RX. Okay. It's the last letter of flavor, yes. So I think from Sustainable Cape's standpoint, we are all about celebrating local food while teaching about the health of our bodies, our community, and our environment. So for us, empirical data is important. It was really clear that if we could have doctors prescribing fruits and vegetables and then getting patients to a farmer's market, which is a really fun, really celebratory, really fantastic outdoor environment where relationships are created and support our local farmers and support the health of our local population, especially vulnerable populations who might not be able to go to these markets, that was something we really, really wanted to do. And Kumara separately, and I think actually we found out about each other through your program. We'd been on your program for some of our schoolwork. Kumara had been on for some of his health work. When we connected, it sort of, you know, the idea took off and really caught fire. We were able to put the two pieces together, our work with farmers markets, his work with doctors, and make this happen.
So how does it work?
Well, basically, the patient goes to the doctor's office. The doctor has a series of health metrics and says, okay, you're qualified for this program. I'd like to offer you prescriptions to go to your local farmer's market. These prescriptions are for $30. It's an actual written prescription. The patient gets a short series of prescriptions, goes to the farmer's market, redeems the prescription for tokens, goes around the farmer's market, purchases $30 worth of fruits and vegetables with the tokens, goes home, cooks them up. We also have a nutritionist. We've been working with Nicole Cormier of Delicious Living, who's fantastic. And she's been, she does a series of classes throughout the period so that the patients understand how to utilize the fruits and vegetables that they're finding at the local markets in their diets. They have a great time doing that. And then they go periodically back to the doctor's office and check in. So their biometrics taken.
All right. So you had this pilot program. And so you have some who are getting the food prescriptions and then some who are not. Mm-hmm. And so to keep them incentivized, you give them gas tokens or something,
correct.
Right?
Yeah.
So tell us, how did you determine who would participate in this program?
So we wanted to study the population that is vulnerable, having difficult access to food and based on their low-income status, and also who are at a higher risk for health chronic diseases based on their BMI or body weight. So we chose candidates based on low-income status and being overweight or obese based on their body weight. And then we randomly assigned the group who it was a voluntary enrollment, and who were enrolled for the program and the study. We randomly assigned them into two buckets, you know, treatment group and a placebo mm-hmm. control group. And those who were in the control group received the similar $30 value of gas cards for gas stations, because that population is also having transportation vulnerabilities. And the other group, the treatment group, got the actual prescriptions. I think it's important for, you know, from a funder's perspective or from a legislative or a policymaking perspective, it's important to roll out programs that confirm evidence using the most rigorous scientific methods so that we know that the data that we get out of it is credible, is accurate. So we were really on top of that in that sense. So the way we designed the program is to make sure that we have the placebo, the control group. We randomly assigned them. So I am blinded. As a researcher, I didn't know who's going into which bucket. It's a single blinded study. It's important to have the control group, because otherwise, if we do a treatment, you know, there are programs that are done out there. We do an intervention. We look for an effect from that. But without having a control or a placebo group, we wouldn't know how much of the effect that we see can be actually attributed to the treatment intervention. Mm. And how much was it chance, and how much was it from other variables and factors. So I think it was important for us to make sure that we use the funding that we get in a proper way, put it into good use by creating a design that is accurate, robust, and we measure the outcomes in a way that is that is indisputable. So I think that was behind the idea of designing it in that way.
And so what were the results?
So yeah, we are happy to share that we saw improvements in the risk factors for heart disease and diabetes in the treatment group. There were some of the factors improved in the control group as well, but the improvement was far higher in the treatment group. It was interesting. I want to just give us an idea here of how the design was done. Both the treatment and the control groups underwent similar nutrition education and cooking demonstrations, exactly the same. They were in the same group. So the idea here is to keep the knowledge constant among the two groups, but tweak the axis differently for one group. So we kept the education the same. So we did see improvement in both the groups, but the improvement was higher in the group that had the better access through the veggie prescriptions. So we saw an improvement, an average drop of 14 points in the LDL cholesterol, which is one of the worst cholesterol numbers in the treatment group, compared to 4-point drop in the control group. The BMI improved in the treatment group. The blood glucose, and we measure another number for diabetes called A1C, which kind of tells us how good the sugar control was in the previous 3 months before the study. That number also improved more so in the treatment group. So we are seeing an improvement in diabetes markers. We're seeing an improvement in cholesterol. We're seeing an improvement in the BMI. across the two groups, but more so in the treatment group. And we also measured a knowledge, a nutrition knowledge based on the education and by using surveys before and after the intervention, a three-month program we did. And the survey also showed that there was an improvement in the nutrition knowledge and awareness, and also their confidence in their ability to cook a healthy meal went up through the roof, and it was actually statistically significant when you look at the data. So the knowledge base improved, the confidence level, the self-efficacy of being able to cook healthy meal, that improved. And also we measured the post, and at the end of the study, we measured the program satisfaction.
Yeah, that's going to be a good question. What did they say?
And
yeah.
Really, you know, yeah. Overall, fantastic results from that angle as well. We, you know, we had 95% of them rated the program as either excellent, very good, or good. Mm-hmm. So we are very happy about the outcome and how the program design and the participants' experience was.
And it says a lot, even just that education part of it. Everybody got the same education, and there was an improvement even without adding the fresh fruits and vegetables.
Well, I think what's really important here, too, is that this is something that you can incorporate into your everyday life. They aren't complicated recipes. It was fun to get together with this group of people and to make things together and to understand I can go and shop, I can spend not a really long amount of time doing this shopping, and now I can prepare these things fairly easily. So in order to bring it into your life, you have to sort of make it easy because we're all really, really busy. Right. But I think there are all these negative statistics out there that, you know, the CDC just came out with the fact that there's, you know, 39.6% of adults in 2015-16 are now obese. That's up from 33.7%. And the youth, they're unclear. They're sort of debating whether it's plateaued at 18.5%, but that's one in five kids almost. Yeah. And so how do we change this? And, from my perspective, it's not this doomsayer, oh, my gosh, this is terrible. But it's, hey, there are these amazing opportunities out there. This is really fun. It's pretty easy to do. And food can both cause and treat disease. Yeah. And so here's an opportunity.
Yeah. And so do you think that we've sort of fallen out of practice cooking whole foods? Because, you know, I mean, when we were kids, the fast food thing was kind of new, and we didn't have a lot of processed foods. I mean, there were some, now you just stick this in the oven and heat it up, and you know, a lot of people say, like, I wouldn't know how to cook that.
Yeah. Yeah. I think there's a huge amount of marketing that goes on now in our country. There's a tremendous amount of foods that are placed in certain areas of the supermarket to make it easy for you to buy. You're tired. It's the end of work. You're hungry.
The end cap.
Right. Yeah. Let me just grab something quick. And so really, I think we can get back to a place where if you have the food in your refrigerator already, it's just as easy and quick to cook an omelet as it is to pull out a TV dinner or whatever it might be, Stouffer's that you're putting in your oven. And so I think that if we can get to a place where we understand that food really is the medicine, and that your choices that you make, what you put on your plate every day, three times a day, can either make health or make disease.
Yeah.
That's a really, really important message.
And I think, too, going back to the affordability of fruits and vegetables, we are seeing in the food banks now fresh fruits and vegetables. And, you know, a decade ago, that wasn't happening.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So that's a good thing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. There was a great program developed last year at our farmers market by two high school girls called Grow a Row for Neighbors. And it basically, they notice that there's a group of people who grow food in their garden that come down to the farmer's market and say, hey, I've got this extra stuff. Can I get a table for a day? But really, we're there to support the farmers. And, you know, that's not really your income. And so there were also groups of people who couldn't afford all of the vegetables that they would like to have bought, even though we run these nutrition incentive programs. So they made this sort of farmer's market as hubs where people can bring their fruits and vegetables to the farmer's market. The food bank pantry volunteer comes and picks them up and takes them to the nearest pantry in need. And it was just a wonderful program we hope to roll out.
866-999-4626 is our number if you'd like to chime in this morning. 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We are talking with Dr. Kumar Siddhartha, the primary care physician and medical director at Emerald Physicians, and Francie Randolph, the founding director of Sustainable Cape. We're talking about a food, healthy food, fruits and vegetables being accessible to all and how that can improve your health. So we talked about this pilot program and the results, which are great. So what's the future of the program, and how would you modify it going forward?
So one of the ways we will modify it in the future would be to look at the program components in how participation can be more easier and giving more options so that it's we can have a wider reach. And I think that the future implications are quite a variety of them. Right now, we are in the phase of pulling together data and looking at where the community needs are and seeing how these principles apply into which demographic. Mm-hmm. I think it really boils down to our community and what our community needs are and how these principles can be synthesized into either a practice guideline or a policy-making guideline to apply for whichever demographic it applies to.
We mentioned that it's expensive. Fruits and vegetables are expensive. So how do you pay for this?
So one of the hopes from this is that to see if we show that this treatment, as this prescription for vegetables and fruit access, is a treatment intervention, if that improves the health that we have shown the way it does, then those who are stakeholders in this game, insurance companies, who are now more and more wanting to incentivize their constituents, their clients, to patients, mm-hmm. to be healthy. You know, I have patients with different insurances coming and getting signatures because they have done their screenings and, you know, they're taking the steps to be healthier. I think that trend we're going to see more and more in the future. And I think this kind of programs informs that kind of policy making at a local level, at a state level, for insurers and payers to see how can we can incentivize healthcare systems that are paying attention to this, that are putting effort into this. How can we incentivize patients who are you know taking part in this and wanting to be healthier? So I think it can take that that direction. Mm-hmm. And I think there's a lot of potential in that area. Mm-hmm.
I think, in addition, that this study, some of the biometrics that we've gotten are some of the deepest dives that have been done to date in the states on patients and their health and fruits and vegetables. We really are looking at the whole person with interrelated health needs, and food is a core component of quality health care. Mm-hmm. And when we first proposed this, we were just very, very fortunate. The Cape Cod 5 Foundation stepped forward, and they really wanted to be a part of it and helped mm-hmm. tremendously. And the Cape Cod Healthcare Community Benefits Foundation yeah. also were just tremendous.
Yeah.
I'm wondering about your colleagues. I mean, are the doctors going, hey, great idea. How do I, I want to do this too.
Glad you asked the question. I think one of the things I wanted to say is how the Cape Cod healthcare system has put its muscle behind it. And you know, we are always there to take care of the vulnerable population. And this is just a perfect opportunity to do that. And so they were, so I'm thankful for the support we have had from Cape Cod Healthcare. The CEO, Mike Clough, gave a nod to approve the funding to move forward this program when we were, looking for those funding. The two important kind of intangibles that has come out of this study is the culture change. The culture change among healthcare professionals who are so used to prescribing,
medication,
pills and procedures. Now this idea of prescribing health, that is a tool to look at how can this change the culture of professionals in this angle. And from the patient's perspective, it's also a culture change for patients who are so used to going for a quick fix and the last minute fix, which is usually temporary. Instead, looking at how can I take care of my whole health in a different way that is nourishing, that is empowering and fulfilling for me. And at the same time, while I'm doing it, I am also, as a patient, doing this program, connecting with my local farmer, talking to the farmer's market. And it just changes the relationships. It builds community. It has a whole lot of other intangibles, right, benefits that comes with it.
You know, I'm thinking when you're talking about change of culture, when my primary care physician retired, I had a tough time looking around. And I love my new primary care physician, but I have to say I was shocked the first time I went in there. And, you know, we did the physical and thing, but then he was like, okay, what are you doing for the stress? And he's, you know, handing me some papers on yoga poses. And I was going,
great.
Wow. I found the guy, right? Yeah. So our phone number, if you'd like to ask a question or share a story with us, 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. So let's back up a little bit and talk about why whole foods such as fruits, vegetables, grains, and legumes are more healthful. So explain what happens biologically when people consume more of these types of food instead of animal-based foods.
So there are probably two main areas we need to look at, three areas, I would say. One is looking at the amount of dietary fiber that is in the food. So when we look at, because dietary fiber is so important to improve many aspects of the health, including our immune system, including the intestinal health, including prevention of many cancers, including colon cancers. And dietary fiber comes from plant foods, right? There is zero dietary fiber in any of the animal foods. So when the proportion of plant foods, fruits and vegetables, are legumes and whole grains, increases in the meal, we are increasing the dietary fiber, which helps us. Number two is something called antioxidants, which is kind of relates to the color in the fruits and the color in the vegetables and the greens. And so when we have a higher amount of antioxidants, it reduces the risk for cancer. It coming from a food form, not from a pill form. Mm. It reduces the risk for cancer. It reduces risk for degenerative diseases. It even helps with many other aspects in our health, like arthritis and even heart disease has been connected with lack of antioxidants. So that's the second part. The third part is the amount of inflammation that we have. So the chronic inflammation is basically like a reaction that the body shows to any kind of insult. It can be an injury, it can be an infection, or it can be food choices, right? So when you have the wrong food choices, body can create inflammation that leads on to many of the chronic illnesses that we see. So inflammation is now considered to be a hallmark and a root cause of all the chronic diseases that we see: diabetes, heart disease, cancer, and arthritis. So choosing more plant foods reduces the inflammation, increases antioxidant content, increases dietary fiber, and thus decreases the risk for the chronic diseases that we just mentioned.
As you're talking, look, I wrote down inflammation.
Yeah.
Because that is such, I mean, you, yes, you don't realize how much inflammation is a cause of so many, including Alzheimer's.
Yes,
I mean, it's,
exactly,
it's the inflammation that, yep, that progresses the disease. Let's talk to Noli, who's calling from Aquinnah. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks so much for this wonderful program.
Sure. Now, and you're with Island Grown over on the vineyard, is that right?
That's right. That's, yeah, right. I've worked with Island Grown Initiative, and we've been working on similar issues and are so inspired by the work that you guys are doing on the Cape. Thank you so much, Francie and Dr. Siddhartha.
Hi, Noli.
Thank you
how
for
are
calling.
You?
Yeah.
Hi. Hi. Well, and I wondered if I could just share briefly,
yes,
a little bit about what we've,
yeah,
been doing over on the island.
Go ahead. Yep.
Great. So here on the vineyard, it's also really difficult for people to access the farmers market. So we began a mobile farmers market program this past summer that brought wholesale priced local produce to seven different neighborhoods across the island. And that was a really effective way for us to help increase local food access. And along with a new benefit program that started this past year called the Healthy Incentives Program, there was a very significant increase in the use of SNAP benefits for locally grown produce on the island. But now with SNAP benefits and other food access programs in question in terms of funding, finding other avenues to support fresh produce for communities feels just more important than ever. And I think this way of tying it to public health and healthcare seems like such an important partnership. So we're very inspired by this story and hope we'll be able to do more with our local healthcare practitioners on the vineyard.
Hi. Noli, thanks for calling.
I think that sounds...
Thank you for the call, Noli. All the best with your efforts.
Yeah.
I think one of the things that Noli pointed to, they've really been a leader in the field of gardening with children mm-hmm. as well.
I was thinking and, that when she called.
Yeah, and Noli's been, wonderful relationship between Island Grown and Sustainable Cape as well. But I think this idea of access and affordability of food is really, really important. And the HIP program that she referenced, the Healthy Incentive Program, is something that has been massively successful in the state of Massachusetts. In fact, it's been so successful that we've run through all the funding. Uh-huh. So $3.3 million has gone towards nutrition incentives at farmers markets, farm stands, CSAs, and farms in the past 10 months.
Wow.
So right now, there's a supplemental budget that is asking for an additional $2 million. It's passed the House. It has to go through the Senate. But 35,000 households in Massachusetts have availed themselves of this program. And what's really, really important about the HIP program, what it shows is that if you provide access and funds to people in lower socioeconomic groups, they want those vegetables.
Absolutely.
They
who wouldn't want them?
Go out
well,
and
you know, and
them.
You mentioned the kids, and I want to mention that because I've been over there and I've seen these kids. And these kids, you know, the kids who know me, I don't like broccoli. I don't like. And when they grow it themselves, it's a completely different thing.
It
they
is.
Love it.
It makes all the difference. We're in 7 schools now from Brewster through Provincetown. In fact, this afternoon I'm going to Provincetown to measure up their schoolyard to create new beds with AmeriCorps. And we do these gardening programs with kids and we say, if they plant it, they will eat it. Mm. And then once they eat it, you start to introduce them to bringing it into their cafeteria, and then they're eating it in their cafeteria. And then you can introduce them to their local farmers. You can introduce them to their farmers markets. You can introduce the staff that's doing the purchasing to the farmers. Now you've got industrial demand, so you're increasing the farmers' profits. You're also bringing food that you know these kids will eat into the schools, and they're eating it once or twice a day. It makes all the difference.
I also think even if you can't, you know, you're not able to have your child growing the food, I find even just asking, what vegetable would you like to have tonight?
Yeah.
You know, when they have a little power there, a little control.
Yeah, the empowerment is the piece, is the key there.
Yeah. I'm just going to quickly say there was just a great systematic review of 14 studies. It was called the Community Preventative Services Task Force, and they actually have done this recommendation that school-based gardening interventions and nutrition education actually increases children's vegetable consumption. Now, we can see this on the ground day in and day out, but it really takes, again, empirical research to show that if they grow it, they will eat it. And this is the way I think we can change our culture going forward. It's a huge opportunity because gardening is fun.
Yeah.
It increases their test scores in science. Well, it's just fantastic.
Just even getting out in nature. And when we were talking about this program and prescriptions for fruits and vegetables, I've actually heard of prescriptions to go to, you know, parks, you know, to get out in nature for that.
Exactly.
And,
Cape Coral Care has partnered with the National Seashore Committee to do the prescription, National Park Walking Prescriptions. And I think, all these efforts, looking at how can we empower the community members, empower the patient population through a partnership with healthcare, using these tools is more and more important going forward, I think. And we are in Cape Cod Healthcare, we are vested into improving more and more of these. With regard to the eating behavior change, I do want to mention that similar to how in the school program, which is a fantastic way of how Francie and her group is doing in the Lower Cape area, the Flavor Products program also showed by providing access to the fruits and vegetables, the eating behavior changed, which reflects on how the outcomes, the blood test, the BMI changed as well. So we also measured the eating behavior using surveys before and after the program, and it showed that the variety and the portions of vegetables consumed improved, and that was statistically significant. When you look at the data, the percentage of folks who are choosing unhealthy choices, sugar desserts, that decreased. And we also saw that folks who were increasing the amount of dietary fiber-rich legumes as protein choices increased as well. So,
well, you think about it, a lot of that process, it's empty calories, right? Mm-hmm. So you're hungry again. Right, Dave is giving us a call from Yarmouth. Good morning, Dave.
Good morning. Hi, everybody.
Good morning, Dave.
Good morning. I just wanted to add my two cents about gardening with children. One of the surest ways to enact positive social change is to work with very young children. And I've had a lot of fun gardening with kids. I didn't necessarily have to be good at it. It didn't hurt to do a little research before I started, just so I was modeling more or less appropriate gardening techniques. But it wasn't important to be good at it. When my daughter was very young, she would just play nearby, and as I would dig up some sod, I would shake out the roots, and she could look at the root system if she wanted to. And when I found an earthworm, I'd show it to her. And there were roly-polies and other soil animals, and I could also talk to her about how the soil feels, what the texture is like, and things like that. And it was just sort of a form of play. Later on, she started to get interested and wanted to help. And so I tried to find, some of the simplest things to do, carting things around a little bit, or helping me spread grass clippings for mulch or something like that. I also tried to make sure that the garden was small so it wouldn't get away from us, because it does need some care over time. And that I grew things that she could enjoy right off the vine, like beans and cherry tomatoes, things that were really easy to grow. And things like, zucchini, that's notorious for being productive without hardly any care. And as she grew older, the payoff was that she was more inclined to go outdoors, more inclined to observe nature around her, more inclined to consider vegetables as a yummy food that she would like to have. And so I just am so glad that I did that, and I would encourage anyone who has anything to do with kids. Yeah. Parents and teachers, grandparents, or whatever, to go ahead and do that as well.
Yeah, and Dave, it's a great bonding experience, as you're explaining. Exploring those bugs and planting all those and eating in the garden. All good. Yeah, thanks for sharing that story with us. Doctor said making that change to a plant-based diet might seem daunting. So what have you found is the best way to get started? Because some people might go, oh my gosh, that's a big change.
Yeah, I think the change has to be thought in small steps and incremental steps. So the first three steps that I would recommend for folks to consider changing is just start increasing the portion size of the vegetables on the plate. So my simplest way to say that is to make sure that in the dinner plate every day, more than half the plate has at least three colors of vegetables.
Right? Three colors.
At least three colors. So basically what we're doing is we're increasing the variety, because the variety of vegetables has been shown consistently in many data that it improves health. It's not just the portion size. So at least three colors, half the plate, is a simple guideline. It works for most of my patients when I recommend that. And the second thing is to think about at least shifting one meal of the week, one dinner a week, to switching the protein to a legume, plant protein. There are so many varieties of legumes out there. There's so many other options out there now to switch the protein up to something that has the good fiber in it. And number three is to consider switching the dairy products to non-dairy alternatives, which are plentiful today.
Yeah. So, 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll have more after break. You're listening to The Point. We are talking about how to make affordable, healthy foods more accessible to people and better educate people about the impacts of diet on health. And with us is Dr. Kumar Siddhartha, primary care physician and medical director at Emerald Physicians, and Francie Randolph, founding director of Sustainable Cape. 866-999-4626 is our number if you'd like to join the conversation. 866-999-4626, our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. So, does exposure to different foods at an early age help develop a more varied palate?
Yes.
Yes.
Absolutely.
Yes, absolutely.
There's a whole new concept called pleasure trap. I folks can check it online. Pleasure trap by Doug Lissel. It's about how our taste buds are conditioned based on our childhood exposure. You know, when the childhood exposure, the child is exposed to fast food and unhealthy choices, super saturated, high salt, high fat, high sugar contents, the threshold of the taste buds, at which point it sends the signal to the brain saying, ah, I feel good. Mm. That threshold is brought way high to the ceiling. So next time that kid eats a carrot, it tastes like cardboard, right? Mm. Next time that kid eats strawberry, it tastes like cardboard. So it's really about understanding. I think it helps even parents to understand that conditioning happens. And as they move away from, you know, as the reducing the amount of that super saturated, high salt, high fat, high sugar foods, the threshold gets to be lower and lower, at which point the brain gets the signal saying, oh, that tastes good. So eventually, a matter of it can take 6 weeks to 3 months, after which time, regular practice of trying to introduce a strawberry here, a carrot there, and, you know, healthy foods, mm-hmm. At which point the kid would actually say, bite into a carrot or bite into a strawberry and say, hey, that's tasty, right? Mm-hmm. So there's a shift that happens. So that conditioning of the taste buds is so important, and exposure at a younger age for better, healthier options, fresh produce, is even better that way.
Yeah, I think one of the things, I was just speaking yesterday with Stephanie Ryan, who's our farmer in the school, and she was telling me a story that we hear several times a year about being in the garden and seeing the children eating kale. Kale is really mm-hmm. one of their favorite things. And you would say, if you serve your kid kale at home, they're pretty much going to go like, ugh. But in the garden, when they're with their classmates, they've grown it, they're harvesting it themselves, they're eating it. And what happens is you see some of these kids actually turning away from Stephanie and stuffing it in their pockets to take home.
Well, I'll tell you another trick. I use this with my grandson. You know, we get home and he wants a snack. You know what I give him? I have carrots. Sometimes they're cooked, sometimes they're raw.
Yep.
Edamame. What? Some kind of a vegetable.
Variety.
But it's a snack, and I call it a snack. And then at dinner, when he doesn't want to eat that vegetable, he's already had
yep,
it.
Yep, exactly.
Doesn't even realize
yeah.
it,
exactly.
You know?
Yeah. yeah.
Tricking
yeah.
it.
Good.
It's okay
right.
to trick
exactly.
Yeah.
Good. Options are good.
Exactly. So can children eat a plant-based diet and still get enough calcium, protein, and other nutrients that they need?
Absolutely, yes. So the American Dietetic Association, which is now called the Academy for Dietitians, has put out their official statement on plant-based diets, and they've clearly concluded that well-planned plant-based meals, meal pattern, is healthy for all stages of life. So whether we're talking about a pregnant woman, a nursing a mother, a kid that's growing up, infant, athlete, it just takes a little bit of planning, little nuance into that, but it's applicable for all the age groups.
Yeah. Yeah. Talk to Anne, who's giving us a call from Manchester, Vermont. Good morning, Anne.
Good morning. I'm actually eating my breakfast, listening to you, and you know, my question is about dairy, mm-hmm. because two things. One is that my daughter is not grandkids don't drink milk, they don't eat yogurt, they don't have any dairy, it's all nut-based stuff. And for myself, some diets have told me to, you know, to deal with middle-aged stuff, to not eat dairy, and I just don't think that's right, but I don't really know. So
it's hard to give up the cheese, isn't it?
Yeah. But I don't know, you know, is it the right thing to be doing?
Anne, is your question about when you say, is it the right thing to be doing, are you asking about not taking dairy?
Yeah. Because,
okay.
Like, I'm thinking about things like osteoporosis.
Yeah. That's a great question. So now we know from science that osteoporosis happens for the most part because of lack of antioxidants. So especially for women when they're nearing menopausal age, until they hit the menopausal age, the estrogen in their system has been acting as an antioxidant. So estrogen is an antioxidant. So when the estrogen levels are starting to decrease during the menopausal age, they lose that antioxidant power from the estrogen. And if they're not eating enough antioxidants through colorful fruits and vegetables and green leafy vegetables, then they're not getting antioxidants either way. You know, the system is low now because the estrogens are low and they're not, their food is not having enough antioxidants, so the osteoporosis kicks in. So the latest theory or understanding of why osteoporosis happens is centered around oxidative damage to the bones, what we call as oxidative stress. And also antioxidants play a big role. So somebody who's eating a regular amount of green leafy vegetables and beans, that is legumes, covers all the nutrients that are needed for bone health, including the calcium, including the vitamin K, including the potassium and the magnesium, the nutrients that are needed for bone health. There are many nutrients that are needed for bone health, not just the calcium. Vitamin D is an exception. It depends upon the geography where we live. If you're in southern Florida, and there's even 20 minutes of exposure, gets the vitamin D that we need. So that's something we need to kind of watch for and extra take some supplements during the winter time if somebody lives in Northeast. So other than that, I think dairy is not essential for bone health.
Right. Thanks for the call. And then we have Patricia calling from Wareham. Good morning, Patricia.
Morning. This is a wonderful program, and I say hallelujah for you.
Good morning, Patricia.
Thank you.
I'm sorry I missed the first half of it. I really am sorry, too, because I was reading a Wall Street Journal article of Tuesday's newspaper about depression and how going to change one's diet from whatever this person was eating before to fruits, vegetables, extra virgin oil, yogurt, cheese, legumes, nuts, seafood, whole grains, and small portions of red meat. Within months, apparently, this person who had suffered from depression for years, it went away. And they equated this with the changes in the brain and the anti-inflammatory part of one's body that was causing probably most of this. And so that was one comment I wanted you to be aware of if you hadn't seen this article.
Yeah, thank you for bringing it up. And I think that the data is, Patricia, I think. Yeah, yes. Patricia, thank you. The data is clearly showing nowadays that food and mood are connected and that clearly when we increase the amount of fruits and vegetables, fiber-rich foods, and we start decreasing foods that lack fiber, predominantly animal foods and processed, sugary foods, our gut health improves. So it's really centers around the improvement of the intestinal health and the improvement of the good bacteria population in the gut, which leads to improved production of serotonin, because most of the serotonin is produced in the gut. Most of it works in the brain, but most of it is produced in the gut. So dietary change, more plant-based foods, leads to increased serotonin production in the gut due to increased gut health, leads to decrease of depression and improved mood.
We've got an email from Suzanne who says, I'm the garden coordinator at Hyannis West Elementary School, one of the Cape's most challenged group of children. Our goal is to get the kids out in the garden as much as possible, but the staff has a lot on their plates and many are not familiar with gardening. We have organized school-wide garden days at least 3 times a year, but I'm wondering if anyone has any advice on how to make the garden more approachable for the teachers trying to make it sustainable. And she also says that islandgrown.org has been a great resource.
Yes, I think one of the things that we do with Sustainable Cape with our farmer in the school program is we have hired a farmer, and now we're moving into more, that are also educators. Those farmer educators can then link what is happening in the garden to the core curriculum for the teachers. So you really do need to make it relevant for the teachers. The teachers have so little time in their day, and they're under such pressures to teach to tests right now, that we have to kind of make it easy for them to want to participate, and we can teach about all sorts of science and math concepts through the garden.
And I have so many more questions that we're not going to have time for. But, there are people who love their meat and they aren't likely to give it up entirely. Mm-hmm. So if we're talking unprocessed meat, is there a better choice if you have enough chicken, beef, pork, or fish? I mean, does it matter?
I really think it's to do with definitely reducing the red meat and processed meats will be the first step to take. And then moving towards, decreasing the amount of chicken and eggs, and then coming, that's kind of the order I would look at. I think it's important to focus on what am I going to increase more in my diet than what am I going to give up. Mm-hmm. I think a positive spin and a positive step is important to think about.
Such a good point. Right?
So I would always, you know, one of the ways I say is just fill up the plate with fruits and vegetables and let it crowd out the remaining part of the plate.
Eat those first, and then that way you won't
exactly.
be hungry.
Yeah. Exactly. So I think it's really, you want to go in with the idea of I'm just going to pack my system with a ton of colorful fruits and vegetables. When I say color, it's not M&Ms for those listeners.
Yeah, exactly. I think there's another really interesting point here, that there's this whole concept that it's your fault you're overweight. I'm not saying completely it's not, but the choices that you're being presented through giant marketing budgets are not the choices that you should actually be making for health.
Right.
We should be eating a lot more fruits and vegetables. As Kamara says, eat more, not less, just more fruits and vegetables.
Right. I want to get this question in there because this is so fascinating to me. And that is, some diseases have genetic links, but we're finding that even if you have a gene that predisposes you to a disease, changes in lifestyle can turn on and off the gene. Explain
right.
how that works.
So the field is called epigenetics, where now we know that food and emotions can switch off or switch on the genes. So when somebody has a family history of breast cancer or prostate cancer, it is now clear that that person now has the power to turn off the genes that they were born with regard to developing cancer. Dr. Dean Arnish has done studies looking at this specifically, including a very sophisticated analysis of what we call as gene mapping, a heat mapping of genes, looking at the genes, and found that dietary change to a whole plant-based diet, along with group support, actually shuts down cancer genes. That is what we call it technically gene expression, so that can be shut down. And then it actually opens up genes, switches on the genes that prevent cancer.
Hmm. And I want to talk about sugar for a second because, you know, it's very addictive and there's lots of sugar in everything we eat. But the body does differentiate between naturally occurring sugars in fruits and vegetables and those sugars that are added to foods, right?
Correct. So the way that the body works and does that is to do with how the sugar is broken down, how fast it is broken down, and how quickly it reaches the bloodstream. Mm. So we clearly see that when the sugar comes in the package like a fruit or a vegetable, along with the dietary fiber, right? So when the delivery mechanism has the dietary fiber with it, then the speed at which the sugar reaches the bloodstream from the stomach is slowed down. In other words, the dietary fiber, which is in plant foods, along with the starch, acts like a speed bump on the highway of sugar.
And, of course, diet and exercise kind of go hand in hand. They're two important components to healthy lifestyle. And equally important?
They're not.
Not.
So in my patients and from the data that I've seen, what we know that is that improving health, 90% of it depends on food choices. 10% of it depends on exercise.
That doesn't mean you should stop exercising.
Great. Good point. So, but there are certain diseases like lung health, for example, the fitness of lungs, for example. I think there the percentage is different. You know, the more of it comes from physical activity. Bone health, osteoporosis, I would say 50-50. So in osteoporosis prevention, physical activity, strength training, and putting load on the bones has almost 50% effect compared to diet, which has 50%.
All right. And then quickly, we have an email from Marcia who says, fantastic study, work with farmers markets and link of whole foods and health. Thank you. I'll be sending a message to the whole Master Gardener program who are actively working to support children's gardens and a number of schools. Just a note to say, the Master Garden program is very excited to support the effort. Marcia, thanks for that.
Fantastic.
Thank
Marcia.
You, Marcia.
Thank
yeah.
you.
Dr. Kamara Siddhartha and Francie Randolph, thanks so much. And thanks for the work that you're doing. I always wish we had more time when you're here.
Thank you, Mindy.
Thank
it's
you.
Been wonderful to be here again.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.
It's always good to be here.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.